Okay, so I'll first give a bit of a general description of gamma ray bursts, and then the central part of the talk will be on gravitational wave. What kind of gravitational waves we think we might be able to see, and what signal-to-noise ratios we might be able to expect with current models of gamma ray burst progenitors. And then at the end, I'll talk a bit about possible electromagnetic and neutrino coincident observations that might be used in coincidence with gamma ray, with gravitational waves observations. As you know, gamma ray bursts are very frequent. They, when an instrument like BATSY was up, there were something like of the order of one a day that occurred. And their distribution is completely isotropic. About two-thirds of the bursts detected were so-called long bursts, time scales, durations of gamma ray emission longer than 2 seconds. And they're seen out to redshifts of several. 4.5 is the maximum so far seen. 0.17 is the lowest one so far seen, except for one freaky, very low one, redshift one. In principle, though, with the kind of sensitivities at X-ray and gamma rays that have been available so far, these would be visible out to redshifts of at least 20, if they happen to be out there. These long bursts, there is good observational evidence that they may be associated with massive stellar collapses, or at least massive stars, and we think that these is associated with the collapse of such massive stars. About 50 have had their afterglows measured, so very good locations, redshifts, etc. And so there is evidence that they occur in star-forming galaxies, and there is evidence for dust and metal lines and other things that are signatures of massive stars. 1/3 of the 3,000 or so are so-called short bursts, shorter than 2 seconds in gamma rays, and these are, no afterglows have been measured of these because the instruments have not been so good enough so far to get good positions for short bursts. So these will be corrected in the future with a new spacecraft being launched later this year called SWIFT. But at the moment, there are no afterglows for short bursts, and that's a pity, because we think that the best candidate for the short bursts are probably neutron star mergers. And those would be the best gravitational wave candidates. So at the moment, this progenitor is speculative, but it's the best bet at the moment for the short bursts. But it's completely unconfirmed. Now, the going paradigm for the central engine of what causes the gamma ray emission, and later on the other type of electromagnetic emission, is that you have some cataclysmic stellar event. Either a merger of a compact binary, which leads to then eventually to a black hole and a brief accretion episode leading to a jet, or else the massive stellar collapses, has to be a rotating star, at least the core has to be fast rotating, and also leading to a black hole and an accretion disk and a jet. This scenario has been called a collapsar often, or a failed supernova. It's not the consensus view, but it's not an absolute consensus. There are some people who think that maybe both kinds, both the short and long, may be explained with collapsars. Or it's possible that the central object may be a fast-rotating, highly magnetized neutron star. But by and large, I would say 95% of the community considers the black hole disk scenario the most simplest conservative view. Now, once you have that kind of scenario, then you can have a relativistic jet, because You know, it's like the initial collapse of a supernova, except that in this case the star was so massive that the central core is no longer able to stop at the level of a neutron star. There is too much mass, you collapse to a black hole. But you have a neutron star density torus around it if the core was rotating fast, and the initial pancake heats the torus to 10 MeV temperatures or so, so you get neutrino, antineutrino annihilation, producing electron positrons, so you produce a fireball. In addition, you may have convective overturn motions, which may feed for a brief time a convective dynamo, which could in principle produce magnetic fields of 10 to the 15, 10 to the 16 Gauss, which are still way, way below equipartition. So you could have in principle an electromagnetic, a pointing dominated type of fireball, you know, a big concentration of energy liberated in a very short amount of time in a very small volume, and that could power a jet. So you could have something like the Blandford-Znaik mechanism if you have magnetic field lines connecting between the horizon and the disk, or the disk and infinity, and you know, so you could have a jet like that. And the reason that a jet is important is because down at dimensions of the order of a few Schwarzschild radii, the whole thing is very optically thick. It would, you know, so the spectrum would be thermal. You would produce MeV, but there would be thermal MeV. The radiation that you see is non-thermal. So the idea is that the jet is able to carry the energy outwards until some point where the jet has become optically thin and then non-thermal processes can occur. Of course, the jet has a lot of kinetic energy, and so it would be radiatively inefficient. Most of your energy would be locked up in kinetic energy of motion, but shocks must occur. They're practically unavoidable. Internal shocks occur because you may have fast regions of the outflow that catch up with slower ones, so internal shocks can reconvert the bulk kinetic energy into radiation, and it would be non-thermal because when you have shocks, then you can have particles bouncing back and forth across the shock. Fermi acceleration produces a power law of electrons and protons. And with magnetic fields in the shocks, then you can have synchrotron radiation, inverse Compton, and so you make a non-thermal spectrum. And eventually, these matter starts running into the external medium, whatever is out there, so you get an external shock, and it starts decelerating, and so you get, you know, radiation from that type of shock. So internal shocks are thought to produce the gamma rays, and the external shocks are thought to produce the longer-term afterglow. So the long-term behavior is one of that initially, you know, the jet will accelerate. I should say that we think that the jet is very highly relativistic, Lorentz factors of order of 100, and there is a good phenomenological reason for that, and that is that unless you had a very large bulk motion, the gamma rays would all, you know, you observe gamma rays of 10 GeV or more, and that's way above the electron-positron pair production threshold. So if you had sort of isotropic radiation, you would degrade everything down to half an MeV. Instead, you see 10 GeV. So the only way to explain that is really that you have so the bulk motion is so relativistic that the photons are incident at shallow angles. And so in they see each other, so the threshold is moved up because, you know, the cross-section then is the threshold is moved up due to these the causality induced so you just do the transformation, and so in the proper frame then you're at threshold. So initially the Lorentz factor grows linearly until it saturates, because you get the protons get non-relativistic in the rest frame, you get your internal shocks, and then you coast some more, and then eventually you start piling up against external matter, then the Lorentz factor decreases as a power law, and you get your afterglow here. And so this was a prediction of the of these relativistic fireball shock model, that you'd have such long-term afterglows where the radiation cools because you have a decreasing Lorentz boost in the observer frame. And afterglows were found by a spacecraft called Beppo-Sachs. These was in X-rays, so pretty good locations, about an arc-minute location, much better than the previous locations by the Compton Gamma Ray Observatory, which were something like 3 degrees. And the X-ray afterglow was fading, and it fades in the expected manner. And with these good locations, it was possible then to identify host galaxies and measure redshifts, etc. So, these how the gamma rays and the X-rays and then the various optical and infrared bands decayed as a power law, and these conforms to the simple scaling laws that were derived previously just from theoretical expectations. So this was a nice confirmation that the basic model is correct. Now, do we expect really jets to form and to be collimated and to be highly relativistic if we put in a, let's say, if we have a massive star whose core collapses and you deposit a lot of energy at the bottom and you let it, you know, try to escape from the star? The answer is that it took a lot of work, but numerical calculations which ignore a lot of things, ignore MHD, ignore general relativity, just Newtonian special relativity, actually are able to show something like this. This is a calculation by Zhang and Woosley, which prove two things, that you can get a jet, this is a star here, you'll see pretty soon the star. So this is zooming in, and you get a narrow jet which makes its way out. So A, it's collimated, and B, the Lorentz factors it achieves are of order 150 or so, as needed to explain the observations. I'm sorry? Well, the jet is produced in a simple-minded way by depositing energy, you know, the right amount of energy, into a pyramid-shaped region at the base of the rotation axis of a star, which extends for something like maybe 100 kilometers along, you know, along the jet axis. So, you know, the initial conditions that you put in are not crazy, but they're not as realistic as you would really wish to put it. You just put in the right amount of energy with the right entropy, so, you know, a high ratio of energy to baryon rest mass, and then you hope that everything happens the way you think it should happen, you know, and it does.
What keeps it going?
Sorry?
What keeps it
collimated is that you have a rotating star, so there is a density minimum along the rotation axis, and so it's the thermal pressure of the gas of the star that does it, and It's basically just the lateral strain.
Does the calculation assume axisymmetry?
Yeah. That's
no wiggling.
Not with this symmetry imposed on the calculation. Yeah. Right. So it's a lot of improvement is still needed. But these already was a very big achievement. It took quite a lot of time. All right, now there is observational evidence for the collimated jets, and it's as follows. Once you get your jet out there and you produce your afterglow, and you observe the afterglow for days and so on, you get the light curve, the flux decreases up as a parallel in time. And so in the simple-minded isotropic spherically symmetric outflow, you expect the parallel to be constant as long as the thing is relativistic. Instead, one finds a break, and the break is achromatic. It's by the same amount at various frequencies. It occurs also in X-rays. And this is what you expect if you have a relativistic jet where, you know, initially the Lorentz factor is, so suppose you have an opening angle, which is, you know, I don't know, 10 degrees, and you happen to be sort of within those 10 degrees, and so initially the Lorentz factor is high enough that you're within the light cone, but the light cone is smaller than the jet opening angle. So as the jet decelerates, the Lorentz factor decreases and the light cone broadens, but initially you don't see a significant decrease because you still think, you know, as far as you're concerned, it could be spherical. You're still only seeing the light cone. The Lorentz factor is dropping, so, you know, you see these parallel here. At some point, though, the causal angle, 1 over gamma, becomes larger than the jet opening angle, and then as the light cone increases, you don't see any more. You know, you have seen the edge of the jet and you don't see more material shining. So then you get a drop, you get a change in the slope. You have a finite solid angle, and that's this thing here. And that gives you a measure, actually, of the jet opening angle. And that jet opening angle is of the order, it varies, but it's of the order of several degrees. And these are all for the long gamma ray bursts, the ones that are supposed to be, that seem to be associated with massive stars. Now, with these massive collapsar type stars, we expect collimation because of this business of having a stellar envelope, which can, you know, provide stresses which do provide the collimation. The same is seen actually in galaxies, in the radio jets of galaxies. You see, an elliptical galaxy or a spiral galaxy, and the jet goes up along the rotation axis, and that's because, you know, you have all the thermal gas which sort of provides the collimation, and you have very good collimation in radio galaxy jets. So that is that sort of is in line with these. And other things being equal, so if the black hole masses were the same, then you expect that the collimation, you know, the same energy is collimated into a narrower angle, so you see the thing as brighter. And indeed, the log n log s, you know, the number per unit flux, seems to depart at the faint end from the Euclidean, so you're beginning to see cosmological effects. In the short bursts, we don't know much about them, but we don't expect much collimation because there is no stellar envelope. The log n log s, well, first of all, on average, they seem to be slightly fainter than the long bursts. And so if the black holes were of similar mass, which they probably would be within factors of a few, if they were less collimated, more isotropic, you would expect them to be a little fainter. And their log n log s is also closer to Euclidean, which then also makes sense because on average, you know, your flux limited sample would be a little closer in. You see them, you don't see them as far out. But we don't know, so this is speculation. Now, the jets, what is the shape of the jets? The calculation that I showed you there, you know, gave some profile, but at the moment I think it's really not realistic enough to draw strong conclusions. However, one expects that the jet would have some shape or other. It's not going to be a top hat. And so there is data which actually gave a distribution of jet angles. Alternatively, the data which for the distribution of jet angles could be also interpreted as having a sort of a universal jet profile, and you're just seeing the jets at random angles. So, you know, the brightness then depends on what part of the jet you're looking at. So there is a speculation that the jets you see more or less close to the axis are the gamma ray bursts, the hard spectra. There is a second class of sources, related sources, called X-ray flashes, which look like bursts, but their spectrum is much softer. Well, it's, you know, 10 keV or so instead of being an MeV. And it could be that those are jets that you're seeing at larger angles. Also, there's been a speculation that perhaps if you see such objects at very large angles, you might not see the gamma rays at all, nor the X-rays, but you might see perhaps optical afterglows, and those have been dubbed orphan afterglows. So far, they haven't been found, although the searches have not been sensitive enough. All right, now, there's been observations linking some gamma ray bursts with supernovae. And the question is these maybe generic? At least the long gamma ray bursts, might they all be associated with supernovae or not? There's been observational evidence in the light curve at late times showing a reddening of the light curve and a little hump of the light curve, which has been associated with as a supernova becoming apparent as the afterglow dims. You start seeing a supernova light curve a few weeks later. And so one question has been, does the supernova occur at the same time or before or after the gamma ray burst? In these latest observation, it seems that, you know, there are only three such objects, so this is the third one. In the latest observation, it seems that it's time coincident. This is a little animation that was prepared for the NASA press release associated with that observation. So this is not a simulation, it's just a NASA animation, which is rather nice. This is how NASA gets its funding from Congress. So seeing it is believing it. What's that? Well, there's been a gamma ray burst, and at the same location, the optical light curve, which is decaying as a parallel, and eventually, at some point after a week or two, you see a little bump there, and the little bump then has a few spectral lines, and the color and the spectral lines agree with what you expect from a supernova. Which might have occurred, you know, even without a gamma ray burst. You know, most supernova have been observed without gamma ray bursts. So, but, you know, there are supernova whose little light curve looks like that thing that appeared there at the same location as the gamma ray burst. And, you know, the thing with supernova light curves is that, you know, the supernova occurs and initially it's optically thick, so you don't see it optically. You might see the neutrinos as in 1997, you see those immediately, but it takes time for the supernova shell to expand and become optically thin, and then you get the optical display. So the optical display of a supernova comes usually a few weeks after the explosion. And so in this case, by that time, the gamma ray burst light curve itself has decreased enough that you see the little optical display of the supernova. And so in principle, it seems that what one might have, all right, now I have to close these off. Oh, sorry, now I don't want to do that. Okay. Another piece of evidence for or against the, well, let me just move on. But the supernova shell might have explained X-ray lines that have been interpreted as iron K-alpha lines observed in 5 or 6 bursts. And so if the supernova had occurred months before, the supernova shell might have been out here when the burst occurred, and the X-rays illuminating the supernova shell might have produced X-ray lines. That doesn't work if the supernova occurred at the same time as the burst, because the shell moves at 0.1 C, the jet moves at essentially C, so it would have outrun the shell. So in that case, the X-ray lines are explained with a so-called nearby model, where the jet then interacts with the outer portions of the star, and it's reflection and fluorescence from here that produces the X-ray lines. These are sort of not quite germane, but I mention it because it's related to the supernova issue. Now, as far as gravitational waves, the collapsar models are only one possibility that is what you think is associated with the massive stars. There are other scenarios which are binaries, and these of course might be the candidates for short bursts. These might be the candidates for long bursts. We seem to be observing these guys, at least we're localizing these guys in X-ray, optical, and radio. The short ones, if they're indeed double neutron stars, they have only been seen in gamma rays so far. But you can make population synthesis Monte Carlo simulations of how many of them do you expect to occur, at what rate. And therefore, what in a year, what might be the mean distance at which the nearest ones occurred, or how far out they are. So these, from calculations by Fryer et al. And Belchinsky et al., this is the average rate per mega year per galaxy, and there is a rate, a range of these rates, the errors in the calculations. And these are the typical distances at which in 1 year you might be seeing one, and the range due to the uncertainties in these calculations. Now with that, Shiho Kobayashi did a calculation in which we tried to parameterize what might be the gravitational wave signals from these different scenarios. And so most of them have an in-spiral phase. Certainly the binary ones have in-spiral phases. And so what we tried to do is we tried to get strains and signal-to-noise ratios where we put in all the various parameters that where the astrophysics is unknown, including the rates and the masses and all that. In the case of the collapsar, there is in principle not an in-spiral phase, but if the rotation rate is high enough, you might get a breakup in the core into little blobs that might cause an in-spiral too. Okay, so we calculate a characteristic strain, which is the frequency times the Fourier transform of the strain, and we get in terms of quantities calculated by various people, Flanagan, Hughes, etc., we can parameterize what is the characteristic strain that you might get in these scenarios, a function of distance and mass and chirp mass, etc. In the merger phase, there are much larger uncertainties. The biggest uncertainty is the amount of energy that you might, the efficiency of how much energy you might radiate in the merger phase. It will depend, of course, on the masses involved and on the rotation rate of the final object, of the final black hole. So we get an expression like these. Then an even more speculative possibility, because really it hasn't been confirmed by numerical calculations, but one expects that it might occur, is that you have bar instabilities or dynamical instabilities. And those, especially in a collapsar type of scenario, might be your only hope of getting some decent signal. Because otherwise, you know, your quadrupole moment is not very large. So you can characterize, you know, what might be the length of the bar and what might be the mass of the bar, and then you assume that these maybe remains coherent for a certain number of cycles, let's say 10. And if it's a dynamical instability in a disk, then, you know, maybe there is some blob in the disk which has some mass, you get similar expressions. So again, you get an expression for the strain where all these parameters then are put in explicitly. And then finally there is a ring down phase, which is better known because at least there is some analytical expressions about it, which are somewhat more reliable. But again, you can parameterize, well, you know, you have to sort of where the spectrum peaks depends on the masses you put in and the rotation rate, etc. Of course, it depends on the mode also. So you get some expression like these, and there is, you know, the amount of energy radiated in the ring down, which here is taken as 1%. And so then you can, you know, plot these. And so here are examples for these characteristic values for the double neutron star compared to the LIGO 2 sensitivity curve. So this is the in-spiral phase, that's the merger phase, that's the bar instability, and that's the ring down. I'll show you in a minute what the signal-to-noise ratios are. The point is that all, you know, the strain, so all these factors can be, you know, if you knew what these numbers are from a numerical simulation, then you could plug them in. These values are, I think, you know, reasonable, but one, you know, they could be off significantly. Black hole neutron stars, binary mergers, well, we took two cases, one where the black hole mass is very large, the other where it's more modest. So that's the light color, that light shaded region and the darker region. And again, these parameters. These two scenarios, the black hole white dwarf and black hole helium star, didn't seem very promising at all. They were way down, so I think these probably are not going to work out. And the collapsar is just barely possible, but if you take the most optimistic possible numbers for, you know, break up into two blobs of large mass and large rotation rate of the black hole, significant energy converted into gravitational waves in the merger, or here in the bar case, you know, also substantial values. So the collapsars, the long bursts, might be detectable with LIGO 2, but you really have to put in, you have to crank up all your numbers and take the most optimistic possible values. And so the signal to noise ratios that we get for black hole, for the in-spiral in the double neutron stars is of the order of 7.5 for one event per year. So in 1 year, you would see one such event with a signal-to-noise ratio of 7 or so, and 13 for black hole neutron star, or 12. That's the other case. And in the case of collapsars, then okay, the previous one was used match filtering. In the case of collapsars, we cannot use that, no templates, but we can use the technique of you know, using the two coincident detectors, I mean the two spatially separate detectors, and using the time arrival correction to put them in spatial coincidence. So the cross-correlation function eventually leads to a signal-to-noise ratio with those very optimistic parameters of maybe 3 in that one event per year. Probably that value, the energy dissipated in the merger, is the one that is the, you know, perhaps over significantly overestimated. So it may be possible, but it would be a lucky thing, unless by accident one happened to have it occur very nearby. All right, polarization. How much do I have? Few minutes. All right. Let me just say that polarization, of course, gravitational wave polarization. This was discussed really yesterday. The point is that you have an angular dependence. So in a double neutron star or something like that, you have an angular dependence of the polarization, and it's circular along the axis. It's linear along the plane of the angular momentum. So with polar axis, the linear polarization varies with angle. And the gamma ray luminosity, or the electromagnetic luminosity, also varies with angle, but in a different way in this universal jet model. So in principle, there might be a possibility of getting a correlation between the gamma ray luminosity or the electromagnetic luminosity and the linear polarization if you're able to measure the linear polarization of a gravitational wave source, which is a gamma ray burst. The LIGO sensitivity, LIGO 2 sensitivity, is not good enough for that. It might get up to some value like that. So one would have to go to, you know, to detect a polarization of some value P, one would need a signal to noise ratio which is at least 10 times 1 over P. So one would need a future detector which is maybe 100 times more sensitive than LIGO 2. And in that case, one might be able to detect a 1% polarization in 1 year in a gamma ray burst. And that might lead to some interesting correlations with the electromagnetic signals that could help verify the some of these ideas about the jet shapes and so on. There are other coincidences that can be used with the thermal neutrinos produced in the collapse, because it turns out that the in a collapse the accretion rate along the pole is different for different rotation rates, and so the turnaround time from neutrino luminosity that causes the collapse to turn around along the jet has a different delay depending on what the rotation rate is. And so that might give some interesting delays between, let's say, the gravitational wave and the neutrinos, the gravitational wave signals and the gamma ray burst signal. 2 minutes. Okay, well, let me just mention that there is currently one spacecraft called HETI 2, which is measuring gamma ray burst. It's measuring them at the rate of one or two a month. And it's getting some fairly good positions so that one is able to localize them with optical and other ground-based telescopes. There is a much more ambitious spacecraft due to be launched in December of this year called SWIFT, which expects to detect of the order of maybe 200 bursts a year. It will be fast slewing so that it has a 2 steradian gamma ray detector that is able to, that gets a rough position, which is maybe 10 arc minutes, but within a minute you can put an X-ray and an optical detector, which is also on board, onto the source, and you get a few arc second positions in less than a minute. And so these spacecraft will be able to, this is the way it looks like. It has a gamma ray detector and an X-ray detector, an X-ray CCD with very good angular position, and an optical UV telescope, which should be able then to measure various photometric redshifts up to redshifts of about 4 or 5 for objects whose magnitude is less than 24, and with gratings even get better, higher resolution spectra for, you know, for the afterglow at magnitudes brighter than 17. Okay, and there's one more spacecraft due to be launched in 06 called GLAST, which will be sensitive at much higher energies, up to 300 GeV, with somewhat coarser spatial resolution, but at those energies, of course, you know, it's very interesting because it puts interesting limits on the Lorentz factor of the source and you know, the photon-photon opacity, etc. Okay, so I had a few other things, but I think I'd better stop at this point.
Questions?
I was kidding about the sensor.
But, yeah, so let me just go down to my final slide. Oops, sorry, which was, you know, a summary slide.
Is there any evidence that the short bursts are not associated with star-forming regions?
Well, we don't know because their locations are known to within 3 or 4 degrees, and within 3 or 4 degrees there are, you know, 100 galaxies. So okay, we just have no idea. Now there is an indirect evidence speaking to the fact that the long bursts are almost certainly not neutron star mergers, and that's because the calculations of the kicks that you get from forming double neutron stars and two supernova indicate that the system would wander out from the galaxy, and so you would expect then, you know, by the time it merges, half of them might be outside the galaxy, and all of the afterglows that have been localized, measured, they have all been found inside the galaxy. So you'd have expected maybe some fraction, if they were double neutron stars, some fraction to occur inside the galaxy, but not 100% of them. So the long ones are almost certainly not double neutron stars, but whether the short, you know, we haven't measured positions of short ones.
Any questions?
Well, let's thank our speaker again.
Well...